bulkhead. The virtual image of the targeting goggles did that to some people. They simply forgot where they were. The screen shifted from the radar targeting icon to a visual from the station's telescope. As it focused, Chang thought the shuttle was the shiniest thing he'd ever seen. And behind them, a shadow of blood. They were space pirates. The song continued repeating. He'd lost track of how many times it had played. System rebooted, back online. Juan fired again, and they saw a quick bright dazzle at the target point, but no burn through. It's got some kind of reflective coating that's causing the laser energy to bounce off, said Chang. We'll see how many shots it can take as it gets closer, said Juan. Sir, the range is making it dangerous for us. The closer they get, the more likely that one of our shots will reflect back and hit us, said Chang. Juan didn't answer. He just pressed down on the red button. The laser fired once more. There was no effect, and the beam fortunately didn't angle back at them. The plane began to decelerate and came to a stop 3 kilometers away. It fired its maneuvering jets, tiny bursts of flame, setting itself into a parallel orbit to the station, out of the laser's firing angle. As the shiny plane lazily rotated, the wings came into full view. What is that? Said Juan, though he recognized what he was seeing. A skull, said Chang, and 2 bones crossed beneath it. They were space pirates. Sack a galaxy just for fun. Then the music stopped, and the station went silent. A voice with a strange accent came on, sort of a cross between an Indian's and a British noble's from one of those old shows Chang's wife loved, about the servants living downstairs in the manor.
Tian Gong, Tian Gong. I have the pleasure to be Sir Eric K. Cavendish, captain of the legally registered privateer Tally-ho, said the voice, and I demand your surrender.
Ehukai Beach, Oahu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. He'd grown up in a 22-story apartment building in Chengdu, but the booming surf always made Baldai homesick. It reminded the big directorate sergeant of the New Year's fireworks when he was a child. He could never admit this to the others in his unit, but he wished he were back home. The fun of this so-called tropical paradise had long since worn off, right around the time they'd found poor little Xiao Zhen dead in the bar, his neck stabbed through. The bulky marine walked carefully at the edge of the lapping ocean water, placing 1 foot in front of the other, right where the fresh sand was wiped clean with each pulse of the ocean. He looked over his shoulder to be sure that nobody caught him in such a forlorn mood. Even in the dark, the sag of his shoulders would have been a giveaway to the other Marines, who feared him. It was the beauty that did it. For somebody who did not spend much time reflecting, he'd come to understand that Hawaii's best weapon against any occupier was its beauty. It made you let down your guard. He had told his men living out of the beachfront houses near Ehukai Beach that he needed to make sure the guards at the far point weren't sleeping during watch. This was a rest and relaxation assignment after the past few weeks of tough urban patrols, his men not knowing if that kid in the alley was just taking out the recycling or getting ready to toss a Molotov cocktail their way. The beach, known as the Banzai Pipeline to the local surfers, was too rough for landing craft and too open for any of the damn insurgents to use as a hideout. He knew it was safe ground. But the men knew these facts also, and Bo worried his unit would become slack. He would find out in a few more minutes if he had to dole out another beating in order to encourage better attentiveness. A few paces behind bow, and about 30 feet from shore, a pair of straw-like antenna emerged from the choppy water. They twitched and then disappeared. As Bao walked on, lost in his thoughts, the antenna reappeared 10 feet from the shore, then quickly vanished again. They reemerged again at the waterline, attached to a small black lobster. It advanced by alternating between crawling along the ocean's bottom on its 8 legs and using the force of the water's swell to help it glide toward the shore. Bao continued to walk along the beach, his body armor, weapon, and helmet a dark silhouette against the sky. The lobster began to stalk its prey, starting and then stopping again, the water covering it. Bao thought he heard something and pivoted on his heel. He flipped down his night vision goggles but saw nothing moving in the tree line. As the lobster made a final sprint to close in on its prey, Bao instinctively turned, swinging his rifle out toward the dark ocean. Nothing but the water splashing around his boots. He brought the rifle down and cursed himself for being so jumpy. The water receded, revealing the small lobster a few feet away, its body covered in matte, sandpaper rough, purple-black ballistic carbon. Before Bao could react, the robot fired a small dart into his leg, dropping him instantly. The poison was a synthetic derivative of a sea snake's venom, and had him unconscious within a second. As he lay face down in the water, drowning, six dark figures emerged at the wave's break line and body surfed their way ashore. They slowly eased past Bao, crawling on their stomachs and elbows to the waterline. Then they waited, scanning the beach for threats, holding suppressed HK-416 rifles. They wore ultra-thin wetsuits that matched their heat signatures to the ambient temperature of the water around them. They were almost invisible to the naked eye, lacking the telltale humps of rebreathing units. They had made the hour-long swim to shore without oxygen tanks, their bodies flush with trillions of micron-sized nanoscale devices that provided far more oxygen than normal red blood cells. The technology had first hit the mainstream at the Tour de France 3 years ago, causing the race to go on indefinite hiatus, but piquing the interest of DARPA program managers working on human performance modification. After waiting for 10 minutes in the surf, the six dark figures slithered one by one into the trees. Two of them dragged Bao's body deep into the thick undergrowth of mangrove trees. The lobsters scurried along the beach, following Bao's path, darting back to the water when the moon broke through the clouds in order to avoid the splash of light on the sand. Then the machine crept carefully forward as a single figure emerged from the forest at the turn in the shoreline. The robot beamed the image back to the six who'd taken cover. Even on the small view screens of their tac glasses, they could see the fatigue of the person coming out of the trees. The figure wore torn clothes and walked with an obvious limp. The robot scuttled forward, and then paused 10 feet behind the figure. One of the hidden commandos hissed a challenge through a tiny speaker set in the robot's carapace. "Sugar Bowl Resort. Best skied in February," responded the figure, slowly turning, pointing a Chinese-made QBZ-95 automatic rifle at waist level, and then noticing the tiny robot below. 50 feet away, one of the dark figures stood, two open hands in the air, and remained motionless until the rifle was lowered. "Aloha and welcome to paradise. I'm Major Doyle, 22nd Marine Air Group, but more recently, detailed to what we call the North Shore Mujahideen. We're familiar with your work. Hell, you're a celebrity back home, Ms. Die Screaming," said the man, who was clad in a green, gray, and black tiger-striped wetsuit. "I'm Duncan, proud member of the Damn Neck Canoe Club. It's an honor to meet you." Conan considered the reference to the U.S. Navy base in Virginia and the fact that he hadn't given a last name or rank. "SEAL Team 6 for an extraction team? I guess it's me that should be honored." "I believe there may be some confusion, Major Doyle," said Duncan. "Who said we were your extraction team? We're the advance party." Tally Ho, Low Earth Orbit. Sir Eric K. Cavendish stared at the helmet in his lap and then bounced it on his knee like a soccer ball. The helmet floated away slowly and then rebounded against what would have been the ceiling if there were an up or a down here. It was his first time in space, and he was enjoying it far more than his time in goal in the match with Leeds, heretofore the peak of his pleasure-rich existence as a tycoon. Zero gravity was remarkable. His body, always a source of secret disappointment, was no burden to him here. The Tally-Ho had originally been called the Virgin Galactic 3, a space plane designed to take off like a conventional aircraft and then blast into orbit. Cavendish had bought it for a song after the original owner had gone missing in a balloon accident. It was partly out of admiration for the man and his inspirational lifestyle, and partly because it was a good deal he couldn't resist. Even a billionaire should not be above a bargain, particularly when it involved a one-of-a-kind aircraft. He looked out at the space plane's wing. The only time he had ever seen anything so brilliant was that necklace he'd given to Miss Ukraine after forcing the manager of the Harry Winston in London's Mayfair to open at 3 in the morning. The look on her face when he'd fastened the necklace around her swan-like neck and then simply walked away had been priceless, though the tabloids had reported it cost $14 million. He was pretty sure that story would be in his obituary, which hopefully would not appear anytime soon. What wouldn't be in it was how Miss Ukraine's visit 2 nights later had turned his extravagant gift into a worthwhile investment. No, this was more brilliant, in every sense of the word. The tally-ho's surface was coated with nano-manufactured diamonds, baked into the aircraft's composite skin. The bet, and Cavendish's engineers swore the science was sound, was that the diamonds would render the Tiangong's laser weapons useless against the tally-ho. The coating would work only briefly, though, as each time the laser beam lashed the spacecraft's surface, it would ever so slightly fuse the composite material and the diamonds. Totally impractical for the military, of course. It was a one-off trick. But as with Miss Ukraine, it was a bet worth taking. The inspiration for the diamond idea he'd kept secret, like Miss Ukraine's visit, but in this case, because it was so mundane. He'd come up with the concept at the bankruptcy auction of a famous rapper turned fashion mogul. Blinging an entire Cadillac Cascade SUV was certainly in poor taste, but the image had stuck with Sir Eric. Cavendish studied his reflection in the helmet floating in front of him for another instant, and then he checked his watch again and smiled.
"It seems they are not going gently into that good night," said Cavendish.
"Gentlemen," he called, "I would like to request your help in evicting those squatters from my property."
"You heard the sir, boys," said Best. "Time for a walk."
Corner of Mission and Kauaiahao Streets, Honolulu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. 21 kills. 21 if you counted the single brown hair from the American officer who was listed as missing in the directorate records. Had he been her first kill? Or was he a casualty of the war? Was that all it took to unleash this inside her, a single death? Or was there something more? Markov looked out the car's window into the night at the vague outline of the complex of low-slung buildings. His eyes tracked to the faint silhouette of a steeple, like catching a glimpse of a dagger in the night. The power had been out in this area for a few days now. Insurgents had destroyed the transformer in the neighborhood, and the replacement parts from Shanghai would not be ready for another week at least. The people here would think it a victory, though, hurting themselves out of spite just to make the other side work harder to win a love that would never come. That was the essence of insurgency. He wondered if she really was in there. A directorate mini-drone on an automated presence patrol had recorded her walking down the street and entering the small wooden building. The drone's small size limited its onboard processing, meaning that it had to send its video feed back for analysis as it continued on its sweep. Carrie Shin's facial recognition match had come 7 minutes later, which was a lifetime in a hunt. He needed to talk to her. If anyone was worth understanding in this war, it was her. What did he hope to find? That they were alike? Hunters, both of them. Markov stepped out of the Geely sedan, keeping the vehicle between him and the target. The directorate commandos crouched behind their civilian-style Great Wall pickups looked tense. They'd better be, he thought. They're about to raid a church.
"Everyone ready," said Markov. "And remember, Carrie Shin comes to us alive. You know what she looks like."
He paused and tapped the sizable opaque visor atop the assault helmet he wore.
"I'll be in on the TAC view with you, so cue her up on contact."
"All are in position, sir," said one of the commandos. "We'll await your go order."
Before Markov could respond, squealing tires made the men twitch, and the entire assault force turned and trained their weapons on the oncoming vehicle. It was a convoy of armored Geely SUVs, bookended by 2 APCs. The men noticed the flags flying from the front fenders of the third vehicle. Of course, General Yu would want everyone to know it was him, confusing personal bravery with stupidity. The faint, rhythmic thumping of attack helicopters circled overhead. A platoon of bodyguards exited and took up positions as General Yu jumped out of his vehicle, waving his pistol in the air like he was leading a cavalry charge. One of his aides knelt a few feet away, filming the general from below, which was meant to make the man look even taller in the video clips sent back home. He truly was a giant, the kind that didn't bother to think about where he stepped.
"Colonel, get everyone back, across the street," said Yu, taking charge of the scene as if it were his birthright, his command voice sounding like he was about to lead an army of thousands into battle.
"Sir, the men are already in position," said Markov.
The general looked down at the cameraman and scowled, putting away his pistol. Markov looked at him innocently and asked,
"Would you like to give the attack order, General?"
"No, Colonel. I said pull them back. We're going to destroy the entire nest. My dead boys deserve their due," said General Yu.
Then a helicopter pilot's voice came over the headsets of the assembled commandos.
"This is Green Dragon 6, target acquired, engaging in 30 seconds, he said.
"General, I must strongly advise against this," said Markov. "We need her alive. We need to know what she's done. Does she have a network? Is she operating alone? What are her ties to the insurgents? I need to speak with her. If you blow everything from here to Shanghai, we lose that chance."
"I don't need to know. I don't need a date," said Yu. "The threat needs to be eliminated, entirely. When the smoke clears, we will learn all that we need to know, that she's dead."
The thumping approach of the attack helicopter changed pitch as it began to dive toward the church.
"This will only backfire in publicity terms, flattening a church so soon after the school raid killed all those children. We're going to lose the entire population. You don't kill like this, not for one person. That's a card the losing side plays."
"It's not for one person. It's for the 21 boys of mine she butchered. I am not writing another damned letter because of her. And what happened at that school is exactly why we're not going in and lose any more of my men. You wanted me to understand the foe? Well, they need to understand me," said General Yu.
Markov tried to shout a further protest, but nothing could be heard over the deafening arrival of the twin-engine helicopter. He cast a glance at the church and watched a young girl, maybe 13 years old, towing two small toddler boys from an outbuilding and into the main parish hall, seeking its sanctuary. As they entered the wide wooden doors of the church, one of the little boys looked back at them and stared at the hovering helicopter until he was pulled inside. Markov turned to confront Yu and saw that the man had already clambered back inside the SUV, which was now pulling off in reverse. He slapped the side of the vehicle's window in anger. At least the general would hear that. One after the other, two missiles flashed from beneath the helicopter's stunted wings. All Markov could do was quickly duck behind the nearest pickup for cover. He sat facing down the street they'd driven up, turned away from the explosions erupting behind him. He'd seen so much carnage before in war, but for some reason this time he couldn't watch. There was no point. The hunt had been lost, the lessons he'd learned over his career of no value to anyone. Research Facility 2167, Shanghai. The fact that he couldn't feel the drill going into the back of his skull made the noise all the more terrifying. Sechen's eyes darted around the room. He tried to turn his head, but he couldn't move. A computer display in front of him was all that he could see. A screen showing a surgeon drilling into a shaved skull. A puff of bone dust smoked up from the metal boring through the skull on the screen. Then the screen itself was covered with a fine white powder that wafted in from behind him. His vision blurred as some of the powder fell in his eyes. He tried to blink but couldn't. Someone outside his field of view squirted a liquid into his eyes and dabbed the corners as the liquid dripped out. A second and third time, the drill bored through the skull on the video screen, sending more puffs of bone dust wafting over. He wanted to close his eyes to stop watching, but he couldn't. After the second squirt of liquid into his eyes, he realized it was because his eyelids were no longer there.
He couldn't do anything, in fact, but watch as the surgeon began to insert thin fiber optic wires into the three holes in the skull. He knew the wires were filled with over 500 electrodes, each as thin as a human hair, that would link with the electromagnetic signals of his brain's neurons. The surgeon, if one could call him that, then disappeared from the computer screen. Sechin heard the sound of metal wheels scraping on the tile floor, coming closer. Then, the surgeon was there in front of him, pushing a cart with a small box on top, fiber optic wires stretching out from it and wrapping around the back. Also on the cart were two robotic hands. Other wires linked them to the box. Sechin knew who the man was, even before he removed his surgical mask.
"General Sechin, it is a pleasure to meet you."
Dr. Qi Jiangong stood with the practiced upright posture of a university lecturer, which he had been before his neuroscience research had led him to be reassigned to the Public Security Ministry. Sechin didn't reply. He was trying to take his mind elsewhere, lock his thoughts away in a place of complete intensity beyond, just as they'd taught him in training. He thought of 23's touch, losing himself in the exact moment of his imagined release.
"Well done, General, exactly as you should,"
Dr. Qi said.
"So it seems you recognize the BrainGate technology. Just a few more seconds and I will complete the modulating test."
He felt 23's breath hot on his neck, then blowing slightly in his ear. His body spasmed.
"Now, there it goes, hookup confirmed. General, I must apologize, as it does seem you are enjoying yourself. But we must begin."
Suddenly, Sechin was thrown back in the moment, and he noticed the two metallic hands in front of him moving, as if caressing something that was not there.
"Yes, there we are."
The two hands stopped their rhythmic motions, and then tried to reach out. The fingers stretched, grasping, their attempt to strangle Dr. Qi futile, as the robotic hands each ended at a wrist affixed to the cart.
"Let us start then, shall we, General?"
Qi then began a lecture he had given hundreds of times, first to his students, then to the directorate officials who had paid for the research, and now to his subjects. It was as much a ritual as a requirement that he felt obliged to follow. He still felt the desire to teach, even as he learned.
"The human brain is the most powerful computer in the world, and if we want to unlock its secrets, we must treat it as such. The neurons we have in our brains fire to communicate, each signal beaming out on a different frequency. These are the so-called brain waves. Already in electrical form, these waves convey what we believe to be our thoughts, both conscious and unconscious. They carry memories, instincts, and the body's operating systems, everything from your deepest fears to your brain's command to your lungs to keep breathing. They are all but simple electrical signals."
Sechin could only watch as the two hands before him balled up into fists, clenching in anger.
"The challenge is not just transforming these electrical signals into something that can usefully connect to a machine, but isolating the ones we want from all the trillions of other signals going through the brain. One way to achieve the brain link-up is non-invasively, by tapping into these brain waves from the outside. An electroencephalograph, or EEG, for example, is what's used by most researchers. It essentially listens in on the electrical signals that leak out through your skull. Such systems, however, remain limited by the fact that the technology is not directly connected to the body. It merely allows someone to watch from the outside. The EEG provides such an unsatisfying representation of what the brain is doing. Have you ever worn glasses? I see you have not. Well, I will tell you, then, that using the EEG is like seeing the world not only without the clarity of optical correction, but with lenses of the wrong prescription."
The fists unballed and just hung in the air. Sechin again tried to lose himself in thoughts of 23, in his mind running his finger along her tattoo.
When I was coming out of graduate school, the cutting-edge brain interface research focused on direct links. The idea of such a jack into the brain originated in the West. Not from a scientist's lab, but aptly, from the mind of an artist. We know that you are an aficionado of science fiction. Are you then familiar with William Gibson's 1984 novel, Neuromancer? If not, I highly recommend it. Not so much for the plot, but for the vision. In the imagined future, hackers plugged wires into their brains to link up with a virtual world of computers that Gibson termed cyberspace. Yes, the very word we use today to describe its fruition. The hands began caressing something in the air. Now, this concept remained theoretical, of course. Dr. Chi noticed the hands, paused in his lecture, and entered a command into the keyboard. Please pay attention. The robotic hands stopped moving and balled up into clenched fists again. Until American military researchers found willing subjects among the paralyzed. With BrainGate, they implanted a computer chip in a young paraplegic and recorded the neurons that were firing electric signals. It was a remarkable discovery. It was like putting the right prescription to the lens. They now could see everything that had eluded them. Soon, they were not just recording the signals, but isolating those that were leaving the brain when the boy thought about moving his arms or legs, even though the pathways to those limbs were now broken. Dr. Chi paused and dabbed a cloth over Sechin's forehead, blotting the beads of sweat that had gathered just above where his eyelids had once been. A mere 3 days into what was supposed to be a 12-month research study, there was a breakthrough. Just by thinking about it, the young man moved a cursor on a computer screen. And with the ability to move a cursor, a new world opened up. The paralyzed boy could move a robotic hand, surf the web, send email, draw, and even play video games just by thinking it. This work became the basis of modern-day prosthetics. Indeed, what your hands are experiencing right now is exactly the kind of link first forged between man and machine years ago. I find it to be a useful test as it provides evidence that the system is working. Evidence for me and, more important, for you. Sechin tried to focus on 23, but found that he couldn't pull up her memory. Then he felt himself wanting to move the robotic hand. But why? He didn't want to move the hand. Ah, you are now likely asking, what does this mean to me? Let us pause for a second as the calibrations begin to take hold. Half of Sechin's brain tried to focus on 23, her breath, her skin, her hair, anything, while the other half seemed to want only to move the fingers on the right hand and then the left. Well, that is where my research comes in. You see, in addition to real-time monitoring analysis of neuron patterns to relay movement, we began to explore other options for such brain interfaces. Sechin watched as all of the fingers on the robotic hands began to wiggle. His mind now simultaneously telling them both to move and not to move with all his focus. Data that can be monitored can also be changed. Just as in a computer, so too in the signals in your brain. We can change your commands for movements, your memories, and most important, your will. Corner of Mission and Kauaiahao Streets, Honolulu, Hawaii, Special Administrative Zone. For almost an hour, the church burned, no matter how much fire suppressant they sprayed. The flames crackled and snapped, lashing out at the sky and at anyone who came close enough to feel the blaze. So the first to enter the site was a machine, a 5-foot-tall spider bot. Each of its legs painted matte black, looked ominous, but its original purpose had been all about saving lives. Japanese engineers had turned to the insect form as the most fit for climbing over and sifting through rubble for survivors after an earthquake or tsunami. The Hawaii Directorate techs found they could also use it for BSE, or biological site exploitation. That was the euphemism for sifting through the aftermath of a man-made disaster in order to pick up scraps of people and figure out who they once were. Markov donned his sensor-laden helmet and virtually followed in the wake of the spider bot's advance. As the scout robot patiently stalked the ruins, Markov watched its readouts on his heads-up display. He coughed and spat out acrid phlegm. Even from a distance, the smoke and smell were almost overwhelming. The commandos wore respirators, but he didn't have one. A white handkerchief bunched over his mouth was all he had to keep the stench of burned flesh, plastic, and wood out of his throat. The spiderbot picked its way through the ruined church. It moved each of its 8 legs with a steadiness that no human could have managed in such a scene. Each leg ended in a flat pad that opened to a delicate-looking 8-fingered claw. While the spiderbot balanced on 5, 4, or even 3 legs, depending on its angle, the other legs would pick through the rubble like a prospector turning over stones. Occasionally, a claw would quickly withdraw inside the body and then return to hunt again. Inside the bot's belly, the pieces of found bone and flesh would be scanned for their DNA profiles and then stored for deposit and reassembly later in the morgue. It was all so rational and smart. Markov wondered if someday they would make a spiderbot smart enough that it too would have nightmares. His head pounded and he needed water. Then a message flashed across Markov's visor screen, a DNA match. A pop-up showed the item and its owner's identity. A charred finger, belonging to a Kari Shin of Honolulu, Hawaii. Tiangong 3 Space Station. Chong couldn't see his hands. The designers of the thin orange survival suit had made it strong enough to withstand an emergency depressurization, but they had not considered how scared the suit's wearer would be. The suit's environmental system could not keep up with Chong's rapid breathing and the rivulets of sweat trickling down his back and arms, and his faceplate had slowly but surely fogged over. That made him breathe even faster. Chong tried to steel himself, gripping tighter the firm, familiar handle of his expando wrench. As Juan had ordered, he'd smashed at the smooth glass of the laser weapon control panel as best as his atrophied muscles could in the zero-G confines of the station. But now, he could no longer see what he was striking at, and his heart rate was spiking again. He was going to drown in his own sweat. He had to take the helmet off. Tiangong was still pressurized, so it was not suicidal to pop the suit seal. He sucked in the stale air, the familiar fragrances of food, sweat, and electronics giving him an odd comfort. Then he saw the small tears in his right glove at the knuckles, where he had struck the weapon station's control system. There had to be pressure tape in the emergency kit, Chong thought, and he struggled to unbuckle himself so he could look for the bright yellow box. It was gone. So was Colonel Juan. How had he missed that? He craned his head to see if the escape pod was activated. No, the egg-shaped craft remained attached to Tiangong. A voice came over the communications bud Chong wore in his left ear.
Are they here? Said Juan.
No, they're not. Neither are you, Colonel, said Chong.
I know, said Juan. The rest of the crew and I will get in the EVA suits and attack them. You stay there and continue to destroy any classified materials. Chong, if we don't succeed, they must not be allowed inside the station. Do whatever it takes.
Research Facility 2167, Shanghai.
What we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning,
Dr. Chi continued his lecture.
Werner Heisenberg was, of course, thinking in the realm of physics and string theory. But the lesson also holds true here. In any interrogation, there is an observer effect, where the mere act of someone watching has an effect on the subject.
Sechen felt parts of himself eager to cooperate, hungering to answer, while another part of his mind tried to imagine a clock. Both he and his interrogator were in a race against time.
This is all the more true when the subject is a set of electromagnetic signals in his brain. The longer the interface, the more we corrupt the very thing we study. To put it simply, General, if you want to remain you, I advise you let your mind relax.
A part of Sechen's mind began to calm, while another part screamed to resist. Knowing that the longer the interface lasted, the less his interrogators could trust its findings.
truth, fear, and drugs would create a cocktail of new memories and new fictions. Chi asked his first question in a soft, unhurried voice, as if quizzing a student. In any other circumstance, it would have been reassuring.
"We know you have been passing information to the Americans. What have you given them?" asked Chi.
"Just some technical information," said Sechen.
The part that wanted to resist thought the best way to do so was to appear to cooperate, to extend the clock. Or was that the part that actually wanted to cooperate, tricking him?
"About?" asked Chi.
"Space," said Sechen. "About satellites."
Sechen's mind raced. Which part had said that?
"We are losing time, both of us,"
said Chi, leaning in closer, as if admiring the texture of Sechen's skin.
"Based on the documents you accessed, it would seem you have provided them information on how we can track their submarines, is that correct?"
"Yes. No." What had he said?
"Excellent. Thank you for your cooperation."
Had he really answered? Or was that one of Chi's tricks?
"What I need to know is what they are planning to do with that information. What other information had they asked you to gather? What was the meeting today to be about?"
Sechen tried not to answer, to take his mind somewhere else again, imagining 23's face, running his hands through her blue hair. Or was he telling Chi that he passed the file to her? Chi displayed a photo of 23 on the view screen, her body laid out on a stainless steel morgue table, the bluish pallor of her skin a faint echo of her blue hair. Sechen tried to imagine her in bed with him, but couldn't bring back the image.
"This is who you were to meet today. I show you her not to provoke bad memories, but to let you know that while I am in a hurry, the ultimate truth I seek is more important than your own truths. If you want to save them, you must cooperate."
Suddenly, the image of 23 in the morgue disappeared. Was it gone from the screen or from his memory?
"Now tell me, why the meeting today?"
He tried to hold on to something, anything. Her hair was blue. Yes, her hair was blue.
"Today," said Sechen. "Today was about many things."
After not feeling his body for most of the interrogation, Sechen became acutely aware of his skin burning, as if every single cell were on fire. His nose involuntarily sniffed the air for the scent of smoldering flesh.
"I am sorry to do that, but you must understand there is no tolerance here," said she. "No tolerance for your lies and no tolerance for your pain, when the very experience of it is merely signals in your brain. It can last as short or as long a time as we want you to feel it, or rather, perceive what you feel. Now, please tell me, what was the primary goal of the meeting today?"
"Sex," said Sechen.
At the base of his skull, Sechen felt a tingling, almost purring sensation that then exploded in another wash of fire across his body. Why? He had told the truth. Or had he? Chi shook his head and paused. Or was there actually a pause? Had someone talked? And then they'd rewound back to this moment? His sense of time now manipulated?
"Only one last set of questions, then. Why did the Americans want you to provide them information about our northern defenses? Does it have to do with their fleets now on the move?"
Sechen saw only blue. He heard someone talking, but wasn't sure who it was. What had been said? Had he answered? He could only see blue.
"Thank you. You have done very well."
Sechen heard Chi order the information be relayed to an admiral as fast as possible, and then felt Chi's hand gently cup his face. It was soft, the effect almost soothing.
"I am not the monster many think me to be. This is far more humane, dare I say, refined, than their old ways of forcing information. More important, what has been taken can be restored. And that, General, is my farewell gift to you."
Chi then lightly patted him on the cheek and exited from his field of view. Sechen thought he heard the whirring again of a drill. But then he saw her. 23. She truly was beautiful. He began to caress her, running his hands through her blue hair, stroking her skin from her neck down. And then his body spasmed over and over again in the exact moment of his imagined release. It was all Sergei Sechin could think of as the fiber-optic wires were yanked out of his brain. Directorate Command, Honolulu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. General Yu held the plastic bag up to Markov's face. The finger looked like it had been seasoned with pepper and tossed in flour. It was unmistakably a burned finger, though. Kari Shin's entire left ring finger.
"The fingerprints match," said Yu. "So does the DNA.
It seems I got your girl before you did."
"Where's the body?" said Markov. "Mixed in with the rest of them," said General Yu.
He tossed the bag finger to Markov.
"Make a necklace out of it."
Markov snatched the plastic bag out of the air with his left hand without breaking eye contact. His right hand rested loosely at his side, meaning he could draw his Makarov and fire two rounds in just over a second. Tempting as it was to think of himself holding the severed finger of a serial killer in one hand and his two rounds lighter pistol in the other, he centered himself with a steady exhale and said nothing.
"You can take it back to Moscow with you," said Yu. "You're done here. But to show you that I am not as terrible a man as you think I am, you will use my jet for the return trip. Let your last glimpse of Hawaii be from my seat."
Markov shook his head.
"You're in that much of a hurry to get rid of me, General. Do you know what they call her? The Black Widow. Your spider bot may have found her, but your stupidity creates more like her every day."
He threw the plastic bag at the general, who flinched as it bounced off his barrel chest and back onto the desk. General Yu started to tremble, his eyes bulging in anger. But then he calmed himself by running his hands over his freshly shaved scalp.
"On second thought, Colonel, my plane is no longer available," said Yu. "We have a resupply ship departing for Yangshan tomorrow evening. Its voyage should give you sufficient time to contemplate what punishment awaits you for striking your commanding officer. Guards!"
Tiangong 3 Space Station. Without his helmet, Chang felt far calmer. He knew he was still trapped, but he didn't feel like it for the moment. He felt his pulse start to slow until a flash of movement at one of the observation windows caught his eye. A deranged face with a tongue sticking out hovered outside the observation hatch. Then someone tapped a gleaming short sword at the shatterproof glass. Chang switched to the camera view that monitored that section of the station for tiny space debris and micrometeor impacts. He panned the camera and saw a man in a jet-black EVA suit, the helmet and faceplate apparently painted with some kind of strange design. He watched as the astronaut began to attach a device to the outer hull of Tiangong. Then, the radio speaker on the console in front of him chirped to life.
"Tiangong crew, this is Sir Eric, Captain Cavendish here. Righto. My men have just attached a pair of auxiliary thrusters to your station. You will now surrender the station to us. If you do, we will treat you as prisoners of war, following the rules set by the Geneva Conventions. If you do not comply, the station's rotation will cease, and my scientists tell me the temperature inside will slowly but surely rise, cooking you to a temperature of 800 degrees. All thanks to our comrade-in-arms, the Sun, who is always on the side of the righteous. This is our last communication. Grant us access, and do not resist, or you will die. Your choice, really."
A burst of static hissed through the speakers, so loud that Chang turned off the sound. He peered at the monitor to see what Juan was doing. All Chang could tell was that the rest of the crew members were arguing with Juan, their EVA suits not yet on. A jolt made Chang return to the window. He craned his neck to see if that specter had returned. He saw nothing. Then a faint telltale distortion of the stars behind the station chilled the sweat pulling in his suit. It was one of the pirate's auxiliary thrusters beginning the gradual slowing of the station's rotation. A steady alarm honk started, indicating that the station's position was shifting from its pre-programmed orbit. They had promised to treat the Taikonauts fairly, hadn't they?
Wasn't it better to live as a prisoner than die as a, what, a pig roasted to death in a box of hot coals? There was no other option. Juan could keep arguing with the others about some foolhardy attack, but in the command center, Chang now had the power. He disarmed the Tiangong airlocks. He didn't care whether his son would be proud or not. He just wanted to see him again. Sundown Lounge, Honolulu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. Colonel Vladimir Markov swallowed an ice cube that had been slowly dissolving in his vodka over the past few minutes. He hadn't been this drunk in years, not since the aftermath of that debacle in Yalta. He was irretrievably drunk, but thinking with such clarity that he wondered how many days he had squandered not seeing things as plainly as he did now. He delicately turned another page in his treasured book of Pushkin's poems, ignoring the footfalls closing in behind him and the faint chill working its way from his toes up to his fingers. He knew it wasn't the bartender, whom he had ordered to leave.
"John, my shadow, I've missed you. What brings you here?" Markov said, still not looking up from the pages.
Ruin was a gradual process, just as Pushkin had foreseen. The poet's financial fall, and then humiliation by the Tsar, must have stolen so many words and passages from the great man's mind. Or had it? Maybe it had given him his real voice. Was it courage, then, that made the poet agree to fight a duel that he knew he could not win? Was the choice whether to die gradually or accept it all in a sudden blow? As he heard Jian's footsteps cross the room, Markov put his hand on the empty pistol holster at his hip, his fingertips brushing where the weapon's metal slide would have been if his pistol had not been taken away back at the base.
"Colonel, General Yu ordered me to find you," said his former aide.
"And so you have, but for what purpose? That is the real question," said Markov. "Let us reason this out, Jian. He cannot fire me again, and I doubt he is a man who would change his mind about the final objective of a long, slow journey to an inevitable death sentence he has sent me on. Ah, that is it. He lacks the patience to await the natural course of what he has set in motion for me."
He looked up to see that his aide had already drawn his pistol.
"Yes, finally you answer something correctly, Jian. Well done. That is it, I see. General Yu calmed down and now wants certainty. Far better for him to die in an unfortunate incident here, perhaps another insurgent attack. That way he does not risk my speaking truths to the wrong ears."
"I do not question my orders," said Jian. He stepped two paces back from Markov, as if unsure how close he should be to the man he was about to shoot.
"Have a drink, at least," said Markov, reaching to grab a bottle. "Might be the last one for both of us."
The aide stepped back again to ensure he was outside the Russian's reach and extended his arm with the pistol, aiming it right between Markov's eyes rather than targeting his body mass. Yet another amateur move, thought the Russian. He smiled at Jian and saluted him with his glass of vodka. Jian looked confused for a second, and then shocked, as a knife blade shot out of his throat from behind. As drunk as Markov was, the details suddenly were very important to him. She had waist-length ebony hair and wore green contacts, but he knew it must be her from the way she didn't even give John's blood pulling around her bare feet a second glance as she pulled the long knife out of his throat. She stepped right over the aide's body, never taking her eyes off Markov. He saw also that the slender hand now pointing a pistol at him was missing the left ring finger. She sat on the bar stool next to Markov, dressed in a loose summer skirt and a linen shirt. Up close, he saw that her eyebrows were gone, replaced by delicate brushwork. She slowly pulled back her hair and peeled off a wig. Her head was razor-shorn down to the skin. There was no stubble, just a bald white dome that gleamed like ceramic in the mirror above the rows of bottles behind the bar. She would truly be a ghost, leaving no trace other than the bloody footprints. He smiled and raised his glass in her direction, a salute.
"It is a pleasure to see you again, Ms. Shin. You continue to surprise me. Or should I call you what the others call you?"
Black Widow, said Carrie. It is more appropriate than they know. Do you know why I'm here?
Yes, I can guess, said Markov. What happened at the church was an atrocity. You cannot kill like that and win this war. Other wars maybe, but not this one. I tried to tell them, but they wouldn't listen.
Wrong, she snarled, slamming the knife into the bar. Its blade quivered an inch from his hand. It was a Type 98 bayonet knife, the kind the Chinese commandos carried, and the pistol was a Chinese-made QSZ-92. Well, that answered another question regarding the whereabouts of Jian's escort. Markov doubted the aide would have come here alone. She still held the pistol on him, pointed at his center of body mass. Someone had taught her well. Or was it natural? That question could be asked for so many things about her.
It doesn't matter anymore, he said. Before we get on with this, let me finish my drink.
He turned back to the bar to finish off his glass of vodka, closing his eyes and savoring the simultaneous burn of the alcohol and coolness of the ice cube he had tucked in his cheek. He felt her hand around his neck. She gasped as the meaty rawness of the remains of her burned finger pressed into his throat. But it wasn't a cry of hurt, Markov realized. She was savoring the pain.
I want my hairbrush,
she whispered in his ear. In that instant, his vodka wore off with a chill. Tiangong 3 Space Station.
Sir, I know you are excited to seize your prize, but you need to let Tick go in first, said Aaron Best, in the practiced tone of a commander used to dealing with very difficult situations.
He was tethered just outside the main airlock of the Tiangong, trying to stay out of view of the porthole next to it. The airlock access panel glowed green, indicating it was safe to enter the purgatory between the vacuum of space and the oxygenated confines of the Chinese station.
But it is my mission, isn't it? Said Sir Eric Cavendish.
Affirmative. But once we exited the vehicle, mission execution became my responsibility, sir. We did not drill for you to join the boarding party, so we are going to need you to hang back outside until things settle in there. Highest probability for success that way. We can do the breach with fewer men, but not more.
He pointed toward the hatch with a gleaming silver dagger that caught a flash of the sun and momentarily blinded Sir Eric.
But we're honored to have you as part of the assault crew, Sir Eric.
Best's logic was as obvious as his sarcasm. Cavendish nodded his assent.
Stack up, said Best.
The commando called Tick was first inside the airlock, which was soon crammed with four men. Once inside, the men stopped and paused as the airlock depressurized. Immediately, they took off their helmets, stripped out of the bulky EVA suits, and secured them to the airlock wall. The men wore slash-proof, form-fitting, tiger-striped gray and black bodysuits that covered their heads, making them look like evil speed skaters. They put on ballistic masks, motocross-style eye and face protection that was resistant to bullets up to 9mm rounds, each painted over to give its wearer a savage look. Another of Sir Eric's ideas, but the men had taken to it with relish. Tick's black face mask had been overlaid with a tamoko, the facial tattoo of a Maori warrior. Hugger, who hunched behind Tick, had used a metallic gold to create hyena-like fangs beneath deeply sunken eye sockets. Hook wore a black mask with almost abstract white brushstrokes to indicate eyes and mouth, like a savage kabuki actor. Best was the fourth and final commando of the first wave. His mask was airbrushed a gleaming bone white in the style of an old-school hockey goalie's mask. He'd seen it once in an old horror movie. The lack of expression on the killer's face made him somehow more menacing. The effect was that these men, while obviously human, looked immune to reason and appeal.
The sense was reinforced by the fact that each had a Taser X-26 pistol in his hand, and one of Sir Eric's foot-long titanium-handled steel-bladed brass-knuckled trench knives strapped to his hip. The first thing Tick noticed when the airlock groaned open was the smell of piss. Floating weightlessly, he pulled himself one-handed inside the main research bay and looked at the three Tychonauts there. They had apparently been trying to get into EVA suits.
Do you surrender?
He asked them in Mandarin. The three Tychonauts stared back at Tick. Tick repeated himself as the three other commandos made their way into the room, each holding on to the wall with one hand and pointing a taser with the other.
"Do you surrender?" he asked yet again in Mandarin.
The three Tychonauts stayed silent. There was no real movement, just darting eyes and dry lips being licked. Then a hatch to their side opened.
"Contact," said Best. "Head on, Tick."
Tick pushed off the station's wall and rotated his body, turning to parry. But the Tychonaut, moving through the hatch, closed in on him with far more speed than he'd expected given their training. Then he saw why. The man wore a pair of orange exoskeleton boots from an EVA suit, their micro-rockets firing. He had a titanium mesh frame on his back, and attached to it were the bulky robotic gloves designed for repair jobs in space. One of those exo-gloves wielded a massive wrench. Tick fired his taser. The compressed air in the chamber shot out the electric dart on a thin wire, but it pinged off the bulky gloves and then floated weightlessly in the air. The two men collided, and the Tychonaut's momentum knocked Tick into the bulkhead. The impact broke Tick's right forearm. He'd been trying to pull out the short sword, but had to release it. Screaming, Tick attempted to grapple with the Tychonaut using his legs, but one of the Tychonaut's exo-boots drove into his left foot with a crunch of flesh and bone. Tick's agony was muted due to the pain pump implanted in his abdomen. Triggered by a sensor in his spinal cord, it released a massive dose of opiates so he could keep fighting. The tiny actuators of the Tychonaut's powered exo-glove now gripped him, and though Tick writhed and flexed, he was unable to escape from its grasp. As the two wrestled, the other commandos closed on their opposites, and the sounds of grunting and stabbing filled the air. Tick tried to wrench his body to the right when he saw his flat sword float by, mere inches from his uninjured arm, but he was unable to break free to reach it. And then he spun off in another direction, bounced against the far bulkhead, and cracked the back of his helmet. The last thing Tick saw was the wrench smashing into his faceplate. Ehukai Beach, Oahu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone. The seals and Conan eased deeper into the thick trees. The robot lobster sat idle at the feet of one of the frogmen until he picked it up and put it on his back, its claws wrapped around him like straps.
"Butter's pretty creepy, right?" said Duncan.
"At this point, nothing's creepy to me," said Conan. "Any more gizmos we've added since I've been living under a rock?"
"Just this,"
said Duncan, tossing a small nylon bag the size of his fist to Conan. "What's this?" said Conan, unwrapping it to reveal a poncho.
"You remember Harry Potter? It's his invisibility cloak," said Duncan. "Well, it doesn't really make us invisible, but it does fuzz the directorate sensors. Metamaterials in it fuck with the EM spectrum. Kind of like how a magician uses mirrors in a trick."
"We've done all right with these," said Conan, drawing her wool blanket around her shoulders. It was so stiff with sweat and dirt in places that she seemed to be donning a mantle of armor.
"But this doesn't smell like a dead goat," said Duncan. "We have others for the rest of your unit."
"No need. I'm it now," said Conan. Duncan knew not to ask anything further. It was not the time for that kind of conversation. From the way Conan's voice dropped with her response, he knew she would be trying to figure out her own war for the rest of her life. A rustle in the scrub at the seam of the beach made Conan fling off her blanket, drop down, and put her weapon to her shoulder. Duncan dove down behind her. She saw a figure advancing slowly, staying in the shadows. The silhouette of an assault rifle showed it to be armed. Conan looked over to Duncan and motioned with her finger for him to follow her lead. He shook his head. Screw it. This was her turf and her war. She leaped up and smashed the figure full in the face with the butt of her rifle.
"Socorro do Corvo Ninzi,"
the man hissed from the ground, blood coming from his apparently broken nose. A Russian. She knew they'd been aiding the directorate with advisors. Conan leveled the rifle at him, pressed it to his forehead.
"I don't know if you understand me," she whispered, "but you need to shut the fuck up, or this will be the last thing you see."
Conan felt something cold and sharp at her neck.
"Major, you need to stand down."
The man who'd called himself Duncan was holding a knife to her throat.
USS Zumwalt, North Pacific Ocean. Mike wiped his forehead with the back of his hand. It was hot in the railgun turret. The cabling that snaked through it seemed to be choking the air out of the space. But that was not what was making him sweat.
"Please take it," said Mike.
He was embarrassed, never having heard himself plead like this before.
"It's a float vest."
This flotation vest was not like the others aboard. It was a dark green inflatable model, the kind issued to Navy aviators. Not the bulky vest in bright orange that just made it easier for the sharks to find you. The aviator's vest had more than a dozen pockets stuffed full of essentials, as much to put a pilot's mind at ease as to enable him or her to make it in the wild or survive ditching in the ocean. The detachable pockets were hooked with Velcro straps onto horizontal lanyards, stitched into the vest, and they opened in various directions, each holding a mystery, like an aviator's advent calendar.
"Pilots wear them," Mike said. "So do some of the SEALs. You've got these here pockets that..."
She didn't let him finish. "Where did you get this? Nobody else is wearing this, are they?" said Vern. "It's just me in this straitjacket?"
"It comes from the captain, who knows you're the most important person on the ship."
At least part of that was true. He'd actually gotten it from a supply contractor at Mare Island, whom he'd served with in the Venezuela campaign. No questions asked about why he wanted the best life vest in the warehouse, size small.
"It inflates automatically, if you don't pull this tab first. Now, here's the smoke hood. This is the locator beacon. Here's the strobe."
He had kept the float vest out of sight, waiting until he knew she really needed it, and, more important, until she finally realized she might need it. That moment was now. Vern put the vest on, moving carefully, as if it weighed 10 times more than it did.
"Well, thank him for it," she said, "and thank you."
"Don't thank me yet," he said with a wink. "It's government issue, meaning it's made by the lowest bidder in order to get some overpaid jet jockey to think the Navy actually gives a shit about what happens to him."
She smiled. "I mean it, thank you, Mike." She wrapped her slender arms around him with surprising force. A call to general quarters, battle stations, prevented either of them from saying anything more. They stepped back and looked at each other at arm's length, then took off in opposite directions, unsure if they would ever see each other again. Tiangong 3 Space Station. Chung screamed into the monitor as he watched the battle play out, but none of them were able to hear him. At first, seeing Juan floating above the limp commando with the crazy mask, Chung thought that Juan's madness just might have worked. But behind Juan, the monitor showed the three other Tychonauts had not fared as well. One floated unconscious, knocked out by the commando's tasers. The other two had their faces against one of the station walls, each with a commando floating astride him, their suits streaming red blood globules into the air. Juan pushed the unconscious commando back toward the airlock, which opened as if to swallow him up. But instead, another commando slipped into the action. This one, much slighter than the others and wearing no mask, appeared shocked for a brief second, his eyes wide. Then he batted the floating commando's limp body away and fumbled with something at his side. He pushed toward Juan with a diver's kick of his legs against the airlock door, his entire body formed into a spear, the short sword at its tip. Juan pushed forward off his side of the wall with his arms in an attempt to kick the commando with his feet first. The bulk of the exoboots smashed into the blade, and the force sent the two men careening off in opposite directions. Juan bashed into the hard plastic of a food station, his exoglove ripping open the rehydration unit, while the slight commando banged head first into the wall. Before Juan could pull his arm out of the mess of the food unit, the commando with the blank white mask was on him. He jabbed the foot-long sword into Juan's leg, straight through his suit and into the bulkhead's insulation. Juan, his body now diagonally pinned to the wall, tried wrenching free to no avail. Chang watched as the white-masked commando drew a 6-inch-long metal stake from a bandolier on his assault vest and drove it into Juan's chest, puncturing his lung. Chang could see Juan looking up at him in the monitor, his face imploring, as if Chang could do anything to save him now. Then Juan's head lolled to the side, lifeless. The man in the white mask removed the sword and stake from Juan's body and slapped tape over the holes in the suit to keep them from leaking more globules of blood into the station's atmosphere. The rest of them began to tape up the other bodies. Sheng Hu, the taikonaut who had been shocked unconscious, jerked slightly when the white-masked commando thrust another metal stake into her. They truly were monsters, Chung thought. The most disturbing of them, though, was the small, maskless commando. He had a tiny cut over his right eye, but was smiling and wildly gesticulating, replaying the battle that had just ended. He seemed to be enjoying it all. The men conferred briefly, and the one in the white mask slowly drifted over to the camera and tapped a bloody stake on the screen. He held up three fingers and began counting them down. 3, 2, 1. Alone, Chang didn't know what else to do. He let the monsters in. Honolulu, Hawaii, Special Administrative Zone.
It itches, right? That's the thing with amputation, they say. Not the pain, but the itch.
Markov was doing exactly what she wanted. As far as Carrie could tell, he would have been happy to oblige her, even without the muzzle of the pistol that she'd lifted from the guard pressed against his kidney. They drove slowly through the dark night in his mottled green and gray Geely SUV, the Russian glancing over at her whenever the road straightened. There was not lust or fear. She knew those looks well. It was more a sort of scientific curiosity. They drove past a parking lot full of directorate vehicles. It looked familiar, and she recognized it as where she'd listened to jazz in the APC.
You're taking us the long way, Carrie hissed. If we're not there soon,
You'll what? Kill me with that gun because you're in a hurry? Said Markov.
He drove on, stopping briefly at the corner of Queen and Ward, just across from the Alto Cafe.
I'm sure you don't want to kill me just yet, especially with that gun. That wouldn't feel right, yes? So, if you can give me a little bit of your time, I will take you to what you really want, or rather, who you really want.
He drove on, humming to himself. They passed by Addiction, the nightclub attached to the Modern, the hotel where she had strangled that naval officer in the bathroom 3 weeks ago. At the next intersection, he turned to look at her.
Where to next? Maybe the hotel? Or did you kill any at your home?
He laughed.
My, how that would surprise your neighbors. You know, they all think you are a traitor who enjoys our company.
Whatever. They can think what they want, she said.
So if you're not a traitor, then you're a predator. You kill only the healthy. A wicked insurgent princess of the night wearing a red, white, and blue cape?
The flag's got little to do with me, she said. I just want everything back the way it was.
You mean you want to be back the way you were? Before the war? Said Markov. What was that like? All I know is the pictures from your file. There's nothing of Carrie Shin's heart or soul there.
You're not looking hard enough, she said.
I doubt that, said Markov, chuckling.
She put her pistol on her lap and watched him with a slight twist of her head, as if sizing up a target.
You should put the safety on if it's just going to sit there, said Markov, for both our sakes.
I guess you're a professional, said Shin, through and through.
You stick with something long enough, and it's what you become. But you're certainly no amateur at this, said Markov. This war was waiting for somebody like you. Or were you waiting for the war? Did it make you? Or was it already there, just waiting to be released?
You talk too much. You said it yourself. We are all changed by war, said Carrie. Some more than others.
The war is all you were about then. Did it take something important from you? Asked Markov. There are many who feel that way. Maybe you are not as unique as I thought.
He slowed the car to a walking pace as they passed by Duke's, overflowing with drunk sailors, marines, and soldiers. He slammed the brakes to avoid running into a short, stocky sailor who dropped to one knee to throw up in the intersection.
Perhaps we can test it. Should I let you out here, perhaps? Said Markov. I think you'd quickly make new friends again. Maybe visit old ghosts?
She didn't reply, but she adjusted her wig in the side mirror as if slightly tempted by his offer. As she did so, Markov spotted the cut marks on her forearms.
The cutting.
Did it start before or after your loss? Said Markov. You know, the hunger won't stop. Even if all of them go back home. What are you going to do then?
He winced as the pistol's muzzle pressed into his ribcage. Your little tour is over, she said. The next stop better be where we agreed, or you really will be dead. I won't enjoy it, but I'll do it.
He nodded and kept driving, humming to himself as they headed through the night. After 10 minutes, he made another turn and pulled the car to the side of the road.
We're here, he said,
pointing to the first security checkpoint outside the directorate headquarters complex.
You sure you want to do this?
Carrie nodded and climbed into the back seat. She pulled out a pair of metal handcuffs. Cuff me, she said, gently. Ehukai Beach, Oahu, Hawaii Special Administrative Zone.
Peaches, I think you'd better introduce yourself to Major Doyle, Duncan said, still holding the knife to Conan's throat.
Conan kept the rifle pointed at the forehead of the man in the dirt.
Major, I am introduced to be Lieutenant Pietor Novak of Viednoska Vojskova Formosa.
He reached up a hand to shake, but Conan kept the rifle trained on him. Polish Navy Special Operations, he's our ride, Duncan said, slowly pulling the knife away from her throat.
I must compliment you on your tradecraft, Major, the figure in the dirt said. Now, could you remove, please, the gun?
I'm not buying this shit, Conan said, keeping the gun on him. Why the mind games? There's no one left in the NSM. Just kill me and get it over with. But he's going to die with me. She jabbed the figure with the tip of the barrel.
Duncan walked over and knelt beside the figure on the ground, sheathing his knife and putting himself in Conan's line of fire.
No mind games, Major. A lot has changed. The directorate cracked how to track our nuke subs, so we had to find a new sub. Or rather, a shitty old rust bucket that runs on diesel.